Hello, I'm Jeremy Rivera, your host for this unscripted podcast. I'm here with Ryan Steva, and he's a small business owner here in Tennessee. He has a company called The Homestead Consultant, and we're going to dive in, learn exactly what he does. I have a general idea of what homesteading means, but I think that he has a particular view, and I'm interested to see what he's doing here in Tennessee. So, Ryan, why don't you give yourself a little introduction, tell us a little bit about your company, and then I'll ask a couple more pointed questions as we go along.
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Jeremy. I'm excited to talk with you. And, my business is The Homestead Consultant, and what I do is I work with people generally in the Middle Tennessee area, but sometimes further than that, to set up homesteads. So that's going to be food production, energy production, and anything that helps you live a healthier, more sustainable lifestyle. So I work with individual clients, both with entire setups of their entire homestead and design, to small projects to just get certain systems in order for what they're looking for.
So with the concept of a homestead, you know, obviously people aren't packing up wagons and headed across the east. Are these usually like people who've like specifically bought a piece of land or property, or is it also people who are in a more suburban or even urban area that can do homesteading projects?
So I consider homesteading, like I said, pretty much anything that makes you a little bit more independent, makes you a little bit more self-sufficient. And that might be just doing some health things. It might be growing a few things, even if you just have a balcony in the city, or maybe you start working with a community garden to grow some of your own food. But just those steps towards that independence and using the space that you have, no matter how small it is, towards some type of self-sufficiency or some type of benefit, basically using the space that you own or rent for that. I think of that as homesteading. And that's maybe not the traditional view, but a lot of those, you know, any journey begins with the first step or the first right. Two steps. And I think a lot of people get stuck in something that at least my group of friends calls the toolbox fallacy, which is, I need the entire toolbox with every single tool in it before I get started on the project. Mm-hmm. And realistically, the best thing that you can do is start now and get some of those skills in your pot, you know, get skills under your belt for what you're going to learn to do later. A good example is my own journey when I started realizing how broken the food system is. Mm-hmm. I wanted to start growing some of my own food. And so what do? You go on Pinterest and you find the cutest looking garden, or your wife does, and then you try to build that and it doesn't work because it was made to look cute, not made to function. Right. And so the first garden I made was an abysmal failure, but I learned a lot from it, and I figured out immediately after we did that, like how to make a better garden, and started digging into what makes plants grow well. And so even though it was a failure, my learning from it has led me down this path. And now 10 years later, I've got a whole homestead set up. I'm helping, you know, many, many other people do the same thing, to produce their own food and to produce more of their own energy and to live generally healthier lives. So that's how I see homesteading is taking those first steps, learning, failing forward. And in a way, you know, planting that tree, you know, the best time to plant a tree is 10 years ago. The next best time is today. And that's kind of a overused trope, but it's true. If you want to learn skills, go start learning skills, get connected with people in the area who will teach you those skills. Even if you're living in a little tiny apartment where you really can't do much of anything, there's still things you can do, like hydroponics, inexpensively, and grow some of your own lettuce. So there's always something you can do where you are.
So something that was interesting, can you tell me a little bit about what you meant by, like, our food system is broken and what your perspective is on that? Because I myself have very strong opinions of that, because as randomly reading something from the 1930s, which was from the Agriculture Department, which said, if we continue to use tilling as the main form of agriculture in our country, we're going to lose 1% of our topsoil every year. And that was in the 1930s. So now we are almost 90 years later. That means that we've lost 90% of our topsoil, if those calculations were correct. And I think the food that we ate, 200 years ago is substantially different in form and function and quality and nutrients than what's presented to us in stores, even with the organic labels.
Right. Yeah, realistically, organic only means it doesn't have as many bad things put on it. It has nothing to do with the nutrient density or the quality of the food. And you're absolutely right as far as the tillage. We immediately backtracked on that and just started tilling and spraying chemicals on everything shortly after that was written. But the by far, by tonnage, America's number one export is topsoil. We export more topsoil than anything else in tonnage, and we have a 300-mile wide dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico every year from the chemical runoff, from the soil runoff that ends up down the Mississippi into the Gulf. And, you know, I have my own views on some of the more contentious points of environmentalism, but I think that no matter what you believe or where you fall on certain things like global warming, it's a provable fact that we're sending incredible amounts of chemical and chemical ag down our rivers that are causing extreme environmental degradation. You asked, your initial question was actually about our food system and how broken it is. And my history, or how I really got into all this, was back in my 20s, my mid-20s, I woke up completely paralyzed on vacation, like full-body paralysis, wow, and tried to get out of bed and just fell flat on the floor, couldn't get up. And so I ended up in the hospital, and I got a diagnosis, and at the time I was living in Minnesota, so I was able to go to the Mayo Clinic, but it took about 9 months to get into the Mayo because they had a waiting list.
Yeah.
And during that time, I started doing my own research, which, some media outlets have told us not to do. And I learned that I could correct the issue that I had with diet. And so between when I had the issue and when I went to the Mayo, I had probably about 90 to 95% cured the issue with dietary changes. And when I got to the Mayo, they did a battery of tests. They charged a bunch of money. And then I talked to the world's leading expert on the condition I had.
Yeah.
And after I had done the research I had done, I knew that the advice he had given me would have landed me in a wheelchair for the rest of my life after feeling like it'd make me feel better for a couple of months. And then I'd be basically incapacitated for the rest of my life following their advice. And this is the Mayo Clinic. So you'd think they're going to give you the best advice. And so that really broke my belief in both the medical and the pharmaceutical and food industry, because just eating good food, the right good food, changed my life entirely for the better. And so it basically opened the rabbit hole to what else is broken.
Yeah.
And so there's so many systems that we interact with day in and day out. And my desire is to see people be able to step back from those systems as much as possible. And and I should step back from my statement a little bit and say, I think that the medical industry is really important for trauma care, and they're incredible at that. But when it comes to nutrition and actually good diets, it's almost like you could turn the food pyramid or any of the other suggestions almost entirely upside down and live a much healthier life. So that's kind of where I come from, and that's what I mean when I say I think the food system is broken.
That makes sense. I mean, some of the information I have points to that there's literally just 1 month or so that most doctors are giving corpus or information about nutrition. And you can see that it's not even practiced at hospitals. Like when my my wife was in extended stay during her pregnancy, just eating the commissary food shows you that they're not actually practicing what they're preaching, because you can't heal if you're eating Jell-O. Like, I'm sorry, that's just not...
that's not how it works.
That's not how food works, how our bodies work. So I think when it comes to homesteading, it sounds like there's kind of some different areas. You mentioned energy and then food production. And so... You know, and in food production, I can see, you know, I raised chickens myself for three different times to varying degrees of success. And so there's obviously like animal husbandry and then growing foods. But I think there's also a third category of like permaculture or setting up things in your growing area that you're not. Like, there's direct cultivation. You mentioned hydroponics. There's growing a garden, but there's also, like, arborism, like planting a tree, which, you know, in 10 years is going to bear fruit.
Right.
So when it comes to your approach to these consulting things, what's your priority? Or is it always based off of, like, what does a typical consult entail?
Sure. So that's a bit of a loaded question. I'll try to get to the first one, the first question first, because they're a little divided. So as far as how I approach in general, I try to set things up through the lens of permaculture. And I think that the idea of permaculture has somewhat been tainted in some people's minds, but really the basis of it is it's a design science that helps you design systems that integrate and work together. So an example of that would be, I might put my chickens higher on, if I have a slope on my property, I might put my chickens, because they're at least part of the time contained, higher up on a slope. And so then when it rains, any of what would normally be considered waste that runs down the hill with that rain, so kind of the mix of manure and organic matter and things that runs away from the chicken coop, now I can put, say, an orchard just downhill from that, and then I can put in something called a swale, which allows me to push the water basically horizontally across the landscape. And so now I can take what would otherwise be considered waste when you're talking industrial farming, and I can spread that across my property, and it becomes a resource instead of waste. So, and then I can do those swales that I just talked about kind of consecutively going downhill. And so the water will spread out in one, and then when it overflows, it goes to the next and to the next. And so when I'm designing a system, I'm trying to think about different factors like zones. So how close, how many times do I want to interact with the thing during the day? And so the more times I want to interact with that, the closer to my home it should be. And I'll use different zones to kind of determine that. And then I also use the other principles, like I talked about with the chicken coop being uphill, so that all that fertility as it comes downhill can be used in the different systems that I have. So as far as design, you're using, like I use permaculture as a way of integrating all the systems together and turning waste into a resource. It also reduces your work. For example, I've never turned a compost pile, but I have tons of compost. And that's because my chickens like to scratch, which makes compost. And when it mixes with their poop, it makes super compost. So there's a lot of things you can do to reduce your efforts. And I like to design systems that do that, so you can increase your yields with less and less effort and less inputs over time.
That definitely makes sense, because in you know, usual farming setups, it's always a matter of scale. You know, they're never farming for like one person. You know, they're taking a whole, you know, that's why we have monocropping happening, because it's way easier to take, you know, 20 acres and just plow down corn than it is to design something that, you know, have you ever heard of the Singing Frog Farm in Sebastopol, California?
I've heard of it. I don't remember exactly what they do.
So I became interested in this topic because I randomly saw an article where they had California has famously low topsoil. And so they had designed a system where instead of typical tillage, they would actually take compost, lay it down, grow in it, and then when it came to harvest, they would cut the tops, then put down a new layer of compost on top of that, and then plant starters directly into the compost with some amenities and things to help with the topsoil, to help with the soil. But they were getting, you know, 400, 500, even 800% harvest over their competitors next door. You know, so it's not, it's like the same cult, same climate, same weather patterns, same everything, but they got such different results because they took an expected system of, oh, you're done, you till it over, and then you plant again, you're done, you till it over. And so they started there, and then, you know, they talked about surrounding each of their patches with hedgerows of pollinators where they could also have you know, bugs that, like, good predator bugs. Like, everybody, like, doesn't want bugs in their gardens, but I'm sure you know some bugs are good, you know?
Right.
Like, they're part of the system. You need them. So it's in my mind of, like, instead of these mass scale systems, you know, it's harder to design a lower impact system, but it's always so much more efficient.
Right.
Because, like, the waste that you talked about, like the chicken off, you know, that would have been at any – I used to live next to a chicken farm when I grew up. And there was, like, they would just, you know, plow it out and there'd be a giant pile and it would stink to high heaven. And they'd do nothing with it. And I'm like, that – like, now that I'm looking, I'm like, that's such a foolish system. Like, that's so much energy that's being just left in the sun to stink up my neighborhood.
Yeah, and in fact, if you look at ruminants, for example, the same idea can be applied to chickens, but ruminants, I can give you a easier breakdown of how the system can be set up to improve that. So we typically think of cattle as you just put them on a giant open field, let them graze, and then eventually they'll go to a confined operation where they give them grain, fatten them up, etc. Well, ruminants, when they eat food, when they eat the grass that they're eating, they're only digesting about 30% of the energy that's in that grass. Yeah. What they expel out their back end is most of the energy still there. And so if we do what nature does, if we actually imitate nature and confine those cattle or sheep or whatever type of ruminants they are into a small space and then move them daily, what happens is those droppings get confined to an area. Then we can run, say, chickens over that area for egg layers. A couple days after, they're going to scratch that up. So they're going to spread it around, basically making a self-contained compost system that the chickens and the cows do the work for you. You get eggs and beef and milk out of the entire system. And the grasslands start to produce so much better that you can run anywhere from 2 to 4 times the number of ruminants on the same land by moving them that way, because the grass actually is designed, because I believe it's, you know, designed and created that way, for ruminants to be moved like that, because the way that ruminants protect themselves is by being in herds. Predators come in, the herds are really close together, and then when the predators come in, they move, and they keep doing that cycle. And so the grass actually responds very, very well to be eaten heavily and trampled on quickly, and it creates these little pockets where water can sit, where tadpoles can actually live in some cases, or other things can develop. And then running the chickens behind breaks the fly cycle, so you don't have the flies you normally have with cattle. And so you can actually dramatically improve pasture and raise four plus times the amount of meat and other produce on the same space, but it takes more labor because you're not just sticking cows out in a pasture. You're moving their temporary fencing daily. And so somebody has to be there at least for a little while each day to do that move and to manage these things. And what we've done is we've created systems where one person can manage, 1,000 acres, but it's destroying that acreage. And we're not, so that's, I guess, when you think about chickens and how the waste that they're putting out, we're doing the same thing with cattle, where we've got this tremendous resource that would actually build the soil and build the, increase the types of grass and things on that land. But we're doing it wrong because it's less labor intensive.
That makes sense. So something you touched on was talking about energy, and I'm curious because you get your phone and you see these high flying articles from Ecoist and whatever of like, oh, we found this new miracle source of energy, and it's like this amino acid or it's this new design thing. And it seems like the information layer of what is truly applicable technology now is totally different from what we're told technology is at. So I'm curious, on the ground, what is the state of, thinking about energy production for your house or for your homestead? Is it, non-vibrating wind towers, or is it is solar still the way to go? Is it micro solar cells? Is it rooftop? Is it solar fences? Because I've seen all of those articles in my feed, and I have no idea of what is it when you come down to practicality. Thinking about energy production on a homestead scale or your home scale look like right now?
Well, there's a few hangups that you have to get over. One of the biggest problems with home scale energy at the time is, or currently, is storage. So most of the issues have really largely been resolved. Solar is really inexpensive. The actual panels, you can get them used for pennies on the dollar of what it would have cost 5 years ago. But the storage, so the batteries are the issue. So in my case, I like to look for creative, inexpensive ways to make your system work or to work for you and be as simple as possible so there's as few things to go wrong. One of the things that I've developed is I actually teach a class specifically on direct solar. Mm-hmm. So that's using solar panels without batteries, inverters, charge controllers, which are all the expensive things, because you can get a decent panel on Facebook Marketplace for, 50-60 bucks. It's all those other things that really cost you a lot. So with some really simple knowledge, you can add in very inexpensive parts, you can set up systems to say, charge your phones, charge your car batteries, charge flashlights, and a whole bunch of other things that you can run, or even, for example, my rabbit hutch. I have just a panel sitting on top that's directly connected to a radiator fan from a car. And so my rabbits need to stay cool, but really only when the sun's out. So it's a perfect solution. When the sun comes out, the panel turns the fan on, and I don't have to worry about it. You can do the same thing in a greenhouse, especially a greenhouse that's too far away to get grid power to, or that's the best place to put it. Well, now you get a couple of radiator fans for 20, 30 bucks from your local junkyard. You get a panel for about 50 or so dollars. And with a little bit of knowledge, you can connect those together and have a ventilated greenhouse that only vents when the sun is out. And so it's basically already automated for you that simply. So those are some examples. Another example would be, let's say you want running water. And I have clients who have water catchment, but when you get water catchment off your roof, there's no pressure to your house for that. So what you can do is you can get a direct solar pump, and you can pump that water uphill and put a tank uphill. And so now you have a tank uphill that fills every time the sun is out, and you get water pressure down to your house that's passive, so you still have water pressure at night. Now, some people use that to hook into their house. There's some complications with that, but if you have a well or a spring house or something, that actually works really well to hook into your house. You put a really big tank uphill, and you can actually get the pressure you need to run your house. A lot of people just use that for a garden, and it works really well there as well, but then you're not having to be reliant on the grid for the water that you need, say, for your orchard or your gardens or whatever. So those are that's one way of thinking about solar. Another is to, you know, go full bore and, you know, get your house off grid and all that. But when you do that, one of the things that we have an issue with, especially in the United States, is we have had cheap available energy that's been consistent. The grid's been consistent for a long time. So people use really inefficient means to heat and cool their home or to do other, you know, we're just very inefficient about how we use electricity. Yeah. And so you have to really rethink how you're doing that in your house to hook up to do a full solar switchover, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I mean, when systems are abundant in one resource, like, you can do things really inefficiently and really lavishly. And I could definitely see, you know, like, for the sake of convenience, there's a power plug every, I think it's mandated to be like every 8 feet on modern walls within a house.
Right.
And that's certainly, like, if you have, you know, it would be much better from a, like, a system perspective if energy were a lot less available, that, you know, running it to like a more centralized location would make a lot more sense.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple things on that note on this more central location. And when it's more available, we use it less wisely. I was just talking with somebody last night and they were like, well, what do you think about, you know, all these free energy things? I'm like, well, I sure actually hope, one, I don't think it's what you think it is. I think you know, all these videos are ridiculous. But even if we found some source of free energy or really great nuclear energy where it was really inexpensive, the problem is that we'd use it to destroy things faster. And that's not because I'm against using electricity or energy or I'm really that concerned about its use necessarily, but that it means we'd probably plow fields more quickly or bulldoze more things or do things that aren't wise because it's free and easy. It's kind of like taking a pill to get over or to deal with a disease when that disease can be dealt with diet. So I actually have concern that if energy becomes too available, we'll actually use it to create more destruction.
That's a fair point.
Yeah, but the centralizing power source, I've done that for a few people where we've basically hooked up their generator so that there's a couple of wall outlets somewhere central. And so then if power goes out, what they can do is you start up your generator, you run a couple extension cords from your one, maybe from your fridge to keep things from going bad, one to run a light and fan in your bedroom. So that's actually a really good idea to have a kind of a central power source. That's really useful in a lot of cases.
So you pointed to like an emergency scenario. I know for some people, you know, thinking about, you know, food storage or thinking about food production or thinking about this, you know, comes from like, oh, hey, things might not look great. How can I protect myself perspective? How much of that is just grifting and people being exploited and being sold, you know, dehydrated food to stuff in a bucket they're never going to actually eat versus something that's like, what are the pieces that are actually truly useful in an emergency?
Yeah. So dehydrated food is fine. You know, stored seeds in a seed bank are fine. But if you don't know how to produce your own food, if you've got a whole bunch of seeds sitting on a shelf and you've never created a garden, you've never built soil, you won't know how to use them. And they aren't going to do you any good, right? So that's where, you know, I mentioned starting small, starting somewhere, learning things, learning skills. I see those as actually being more important than the stored food and the stored seeds and the, you know, and a lot of people don't think about how important water is. So they store, you know, a year's worth of food, but they don't think about where their water's coming from.
Right.
So one of the things, because earlier you had asked me about what do I do in a consult? What does that look like? And I never really answered you about that. One of the things that I do is before doing an on-site consult with somebody, I send out a questionnaire. And the questionnaire gives me ideas like how much land do they have, you know, what kind of slope they have on their land, what kind of resources they have on their land, what do they have for resources, how much time do they have to put into things, and a handful of, and then I also have a list of about 10 different things where I ask, hey, can you put these in order what your priorities are? And one of them, it's like water security, food security, physical security, better health, more relaxing. Like, what are the things that are a priority for you in homesteading? And there's a big Venn diagram overlap of homesteading and preparedness. But some people aren't doing it for preparedness. They're doing it for health reasons, which in some ways is preparedness as well. If we have a big societal issue and you need medication that you don't have because you're unhealthy because you're living a unhealthy lifestyle, you know, so you can see there's big overlaps in all of this. But basically when I do a consult, I'm looking at the whole picture to the extent that I can and saying, what are the things that are actually one, most important to you as a person, and two, some of the areas where maybe I can help you understand where there's some weaknesses in your plan. And if that's water, you know, that's one that comes up a lot, is nobody's thinking about, okay, what if the city, their water system breaks or the power goes out for a long period of time and you can't get water, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to drink? And that's, you know, that's a really high priority to me. And there's some fairly simple solutions, at least on the basic preparedness side for that. So, I do think there is, back to your point, I do think that there is some grift, for sure. I think there's a lot of fear mongering in the preparedness community where people will literally spend their life savings on stuff that they don't even know how to use. An example of this would be, there's a lady I was helping. She had prepared for Y2K and she basically spent all her money on it and she was having to sell her home. And as we were cleaning things out, I found like 40 or 50, you know, like oil lamps.
Yeah.
And she had like 10 half gallon jugs of oil. Like she couldn't even fill all the lamps once.
right.
And so people aren't, oftentimes they get afraid and we make bad decisions when we're afraid, and buy things that we don't need. And I really hate that. I hate the grift. And so I want people to actually be prepared and then actually have the skills to use those things that they did get, the things that they do need, to build and piece together what they need. Cause I think the skills are more important oftentimes than the items.
So like coming up, on a good stopping point, but I want to kind of touch on your idea of like, what are the top two skills that anyone should look at if they're starting down the path of homesteading, and then one project where they could apply those skills realistically. Like,
sure. Like
what's the easiest, peasiest place to start when it comes to the type of skills that you're talking about there, and then like an applicable project where somebody could listen to this and be like, okay, well, I'll do that, and then I'll try that. What would that be?
So one of the things I love recommending and getting people engaged with is troubleshooting or problem solving. And troubleshooting really, in a lot of ways, there's a lot of crossover with the true scientific method of, you know, you create a hypothesis and then you try to prove that hypothesis wrong. Mm-hmm. So when you have something that breaks, instead of immediately throwing it away or whatever, maybe start to try to figure it out. And there's tons of videos and things on YouTube on how to fix things. And so as you're, you know, go through, and even if you break it, if you're going to throw it out, who cares? So if you start to learn troubleshooting, it's just a skill set that starts to embed in your mind. And when you, so then when you start to say garden and you have an issue with something, you think through it as a greater system rather than like, how do I solve the one problem that I have right now? It's how do I like, what, how does this entire system work together so that I can solve the problem and make a better system, rather than, you know, take a pill and make it better or spray something and make it better. So yeah, troubleshooting would be probably my biggest recommendation as far as something to learn. But I also say like, learn everything you can. As you start to listen to different people, see different videos, you'll start to be able to pick out the BS and recognize what isn't true and what is true as you also start to do those projects. You know, when I planted my first garden, I started to realize that the people that told me to do this didn't do it themselves because it didn't work, right?
Yeah, I watched a video where somebody starts out and somebody's got a can of soda and then they freeze it and then they use a jigsaw to cut off the bottoms and then they unfold it and they flatten it out and then they crinkle it and then they used it to make a mold and then they use another tool to, you know, at the end, after 50 frustrating steps, he turns it into like the pad for an office chair. And you're just like, you just used... showed me that you've got a laser saw, you've got a Dremel, you've got these machines, and what you did with it is this incredibly crappy product, and it's overcomplicated. So it sounds like filtering, it's almost troubleshooting for information is what you're talking about. Of like, as you actually learn, put... you know, take some of the things that you're learning about and put your hands to them. You learn troubleshooting when it comes to, okay, what are good sources of information? What are they saying that's actually true and applicable? Which is interesting because I was, you know, part of my mind was like, oh, he's going to say, you know, start a small garden plot, you know, and just like put something in the earth and have it grow and die so that you can figure out how it grows and dies. But instead you're talking about, you know, troubleshooting and troubleshooting information. But I like that better because we don't have flying cars. We're not Jetsons, but we have such incredible technology at our fingers. Anybody can attend MIT right now. You can literally go and attend MIT level classes. But we don't. We watch cat videos instead.
Right.
So maybe, you know, watching a few gardening videos and figuring out what's going to work or is true, and figuring out, like, oh, hey, my flashlight broke. Let's not buy a new one. Let's take it apart and see if we can fix it. So I like that mentality. Really love that, actually. So won't you tell me if people are interested in working with you, where can they find you? As a last aside.
Yeah, absolutely. So before I get to that, I just want to say thank you for having me on. But also what I do and what I want to do is make sure that our community is more connected. is more capable and competent in more things. So I teach a lot of classes. So if there's people in the area who want to host a different class or something like that, I've really started to do that for free just to give back to the community and also to get a chance to be in front of people. And those have inspired a lot of different things, gotten a lot of people connected. And I absolutely love seeing that. So whether that's Sparta, Cookeville, Spencer, more out by me, which is closer to Lebanon, anybody who's wanting to do that, feel free to reach out to me. And the best way to get a hold of me is just go to my website, thehomesteadconsultant.com. I say what I do, I do what I say. So the Homestead Consultant at thehomesteadconsultant.com. And you can find all my contact information, my phone number, my email. Everything's up there. You can even find I've posted some of my YouTube videos there, but if you just search the Homestead Consultant on YouTube, I've got a whole bunch of instructional videos on how to do some really cool things like the swales I talked about earlier on in this interview. I've got an entire series on how to dig your own swales, how they work, what they do, how to find contour, all the things you need to know. And so you could go watch all those videos and put in your own swale and start your own orchard that way. So for projects you can do, that'd be one place to start. But that's how people get a hold of me, is through my website. And I love just answering questions, getting emails from people. I'm happy to help anybody in our community.
Thanks so much for your time, Ryan. That's been awesome. Yep. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.